You are listening to WSLR 96.5 LPFM in Sarasota, Florida. We are your true community radio station, and stay tuned for another edition of the Surreal News, your weapon of mass instruction. Don't touch that dial. All right, well, we've got a packed show this morning. We're going to take down that music. I'm Steve Norris, and my co-host this morning, as usual, is Lou Larini. Good morning, Lou. Get that mic a little closer, if you would.
Good morning, Steve. Whoa, I know I'm just going to have to kind of lean forward a little bit, because we not only have a packed show, but we have a packed studio.
We do. All right, everybody make noise at your mic so I can make sure.
Good morning, Steve. Guys. How are you doing, buddy?
Hey, good morning, Steve.
Good. John, make some noise into that
morning,
mic.
Steve.
Well, let me just tell everybody who's here. We've got you know, Gene Jones from Florida Veterans for Common Sense, and his colleague John Dvorak, and those folks are going to be talking to us a little bit later about a global warming, global dying, as we like to say, on Surreal News Study.
Not global warming, it's global dying.
That you fellas did. And we also have retired physician, Dr. Richard Conrad, and Glenn Gibellina, two local activists from Manatee County who are endeavoring to bring a wonderful program called Remote Area Medical into Florida and into our area, which we surely need. But first, we're going to do some news, right, Steve?
Yes, and if people miss any part of this or any of our other shows, we are a podcast at thesurrealnews.com. We're also streaming live at WSLR.org. And, of course, we're on the air at 96.5 LPFM in Sarasota, Florida. All right, let's go to China here. What's going on? They're putting the press in jail.
Reporters, that's right. China is the world's worst jailer of the press. According to a global tally, the Committee to Protect Journalists identified 220 journalists in jail around the world in 2014, an increase of 9 from 2013. The tally marks the second highest number of journalists in jail since CPJ began taking annual censuses of imprisoned journalists in 1990 and highlights a resurgence of authoritarian governments in countries such as China, Ethiopia, Burma, and Egypt. China's use of anti-state charges and Iran's revolving door policy in imprisoning reporters, bloggers, editors, and photographers earned the two countries the dubious distinction of being the world's worst and second worst jailers of journalists, respectively. Together, China and Iran are holding about a third of the journalists tallied globally, despite speculation that new leaders who took the reins in each country in 2013 might implement liberal reforms. Oh, well.
Yeah, we've already reported that being a journalist is the most dangerous job in the world.
And it's actually rated as actually one of the worst jobs ever to have. And while, you know, I did it for a number of years.
Here we are.
Working for newspapers.
Why are we here?
I have to say it does become an obsession. And it is. I don't know, dare I say, it was really a lot of fun.
It's rewarding.
Yeah, I mean, if my employers had known, I would have done it for free, even though they kind of only didn't pay me that much anyway. It was close to working for free.
You're doing it for free now.
Yeah, that's right.
Our U.S. wealth gap hits a record high in the 30 years since the Federal Reserve started collecting data. It has never been this bad in the divide between the rich and everyone else, according to new analysis from Pew Research Center. The gap was the biggest since 83, where the upper income was 6.6 times that of middle income families, up from 6.2 in 2010. That's in 2013. The same upper-income families have 70 times wealthier than low-income families. Again, a record gap. The main reasons for the gap, stagnant middle-class wages, rising wealth of America's richest families. The median wealth was flat between 2010 and 2013, stuck at about a little over 95 grand. The upper-income families jumped from over 639,000 to 500 of 639,000 from 593,000. Lower income dropped from nine from 10,000. And this is from the Pew Research. They divided the country into three groups, high, low, and middle. Middle class by adjusting the family's income according to the size, et cetera, and compared it to the nation's middle median family income. The report focused on wealth. It gave broader income, a broader picture of a family's financial situation, looking at wealth rather than income. And wealth looks at assets like houses, stocks, minus the debts they owe. All right, so that's kind of disturbing here, the wealth gap reaching a record high here in the United States. A little disturbing.
Well, you know, we could once again devote an entire show to that particular story, but, you know, the great economist Joseph Stiglitz points out that one of the real problems now, as we've addressed on this show, and especially Rana Buzzini did with her march to, you know, Tallahassee, is that really rich people have lots of money to give to politicians to keep the policies going so that they continue to be really rich and get richer.
Yes.
And so there is a connection.
And speaking of the fat, it's now considered a disability in Europe?
It is. The EU court has ruled that fatness can constitute a disability. Fatness can constitute a disability for the purposes of the European Union Equality at Work legislation, Europe's highest court has ruled. The judgment means that British companies will be required to treat obese workers as disabled, providing them with larger seats, special parking spaces, and other facilities. Obesity can constitute a disability when within the meaning of the Employment Equality Directive, the court ruled. I mean, essentially what this came from was the EU court ruling, which is binding on British employers, follows a case brought by Carsten Kartloff, a Danish childminder, I guess, who claimed that he was sacked by his local authority, fired. This report comes from The Guardian. That's why it's got kind of British stuff in it. Sacked by his local authority employer because he was so overweight. Important to the ruling in the EU court's judgment is that the origin of the disability is irrelevant, even if someone's gross obesity is caused by overeating or gluttony. I mean, apparently this guy was fired because, you know, and they say he was 25 stone. I don't know what that is, but I saw a picture of him on the internet. You know, three bills plus. You know, that he required help from a colleague to tie up children's shoes, and that's why he got fired. Apparently, childminder is British for daycare worker. So,
okay.
So I mean, I'm assuming that's what it is. But that's very interesting and you know, very broad-minded once again of the British. I know there are some here in this country that would refer to it as yet more evidence of that socialist nanny state that pervades Britain or pervades Europe, or just some of us would just call it being kind.
Alrighty. More medical stuff we'll get to later with our remote area medical people. I'm going to go back to the financial stuff in that the feds, well, they're giving Wall Street another holiday gift here, like we haven't given them everything already. Here, Christmas came early. The Fed decided yesterday to grant the banks an extra year to comply with one of the key provisions of the Volcker Rule. And this gives the financial lobbyists more time to kill the regulation, too. This provision of the Volcker Rule was a key element of the Dodd-Frank 210 bill, reform bill that bans banks from engaging in proprietary trading, especially the speculative deals that are designed to only benefit the banks themselves rather than the clients. So the move yesterday gave the banks another year to unwind these risky investments by the private equity firms and specialty security projects. It also plans to extend the deadline by another year. Yes, they're going to make it worse, and that would give Wall Street a two-year reprieve. Yes, through 2016 election. And there's other things going on with the Fed here. Congress granted Wall Street a reprieve. Remember in that in the bill they just signed, that was the Dodd-Frank law, and this was the swaps push-out rule that eliminated federal subsidies for trading in risky derivatives. Yeah, that was part of the new federal budget that was passed. Yep.
Right, that trillion-dollar-plus budget, they did slip these things in, and under the cover of darkness when there were about maybe like five members in the House.
And the other thing, which is not part of the vocal rule, but and not giving Wall Street a gift, but just plain giving a gift to the politicians, was that they increased the limit that individuals could give up to $1.5 million. This was the Granny D project stuff,
right,
making that worse.
That's right.
Oh, Christmas comes early for the super rich here.
Well, you know, I think if you want to learn more about it, you could probably just Google Senator Elizabeth Warren, because she's about the only one that's screaming about it.
Indeed. All right, so if we went to New York and we had a pet, what couldn't we do there anymore?
Well, you know, this is very surreal that New York State has decided to ban pet tattooing and piercing under state law.
Do you really need to put a tattoo and piercing in your pet?
Well,
really?
Well, my question is, do you need to pass a law to prevent people from doing it?
Apparently so.
Apparently.
Yes, apparently.
Apparently so.
That's New York.
Assemblywoman Linda Rosenfeld, a Democrat from Manhattan, introduced a bill in 2011 after hearing about a Pennsylvania woman who had attempted to sell on the Internet gothic kittens with piercings down their necks and spines. That sounds horrible. And the bill gained steam earlier this year when a Brooklyn resident tattooed his pit bull while the dog was unconscious during spleen surgery and posted a photo of the ink work on social media. I mean,
Okay.
All right.
That's surreal news for you.
Whatever. It is surreal. It is. I don't know what's more surreal, the fact that they passed the law, like I said, or that people actually do this.
Well, here's no good segue here, but we're going to go to Colorado, where other states are suing Colorado over their marijuana legalization law. Yeah, it's true. So a lot of stuff going on in the courts here. So the states of Nebraska and Oklahoma filed a federal lawsuit in U.S. Supreme Court yesterday, claiming that Colorado legalization of recreational marijuana is unconstitutional under federal law. All right, so here's the quote from Nebraska Attorney General. Federal law undisputedly prohibits the production and sale of marijuana. Colorado has undermined the United States Constitution, and I hope the U.S. Supreme Court will uphold our constitutional privilege. All right, so Attorney General for Colorado said, well, because neighboring states have expressed concern about Colorado growing marijuana coming to their states, we're not surprised by this action. However, it appears the plaintiff's primary grievance stems from non-enforcement of federal laws regarding marijuana, as opposed to choices made by the voters of Colorado. We believe the suit is without merit and will vigorously defend it against it in the U.S. Supreme Court. So we have different states now fighting over the legalization of marijuana. Interesting. I think they're just jealous.
Well, you know, I think you could have seen it, and that was one of the things that people talked about. You know, it's the border states, you know, the ones that are like next to Colorado. And is this going to be like, I mean, I know when I lived in Massachusetts, Massachusetts is like a dry state on Sundays, but New Hampshire isn't. So some people would just drive over the border to New Hampshire to buy beer on Sunday, you know, and there was the huge state run liquor store was like right as you crossed over the border. It was right there.
Big surprise there.
Yeah. And so, you know, I mean, I guess apparently, you know, they're afraid that there's going to be like, you know, pot stores right around
the corner.
All right,
let's just quickly just mention the headlines for our two next stories. We'll get to a quick media matters minute, and then I think we're done. So tell us about, if we want to know real quickly about DNA, how we can know more about that on the Internet.
Well, I mean, geneticists have begun tests of you know, an Internet sort of catalog or an Internet applicable catalog for DNA, so that you know, genetic researchers can have, like, basically it's going to be a simple search engine, and they can look up you know certain DNAs. This came about because DNA genomes have come down in price so much that there's like tons of them, and they're trying to figure out a logical way to use them in research, catalog them.
Right.
Yeah.
I wonder what the privacy issues there. I'm sure there's a lot of legal issues associated with that.
Yeah.
We're not going to have time to get to.
No.
The other story we're not going to have time to is our 3D printer story. So we love these 3D printer stories. And when they print things, it's generally rigid, usually using plastic and other materials.
Right, yeah.
So they did a 3D printing of a dress that flowed like fabric. And the breakthrough here, I'm not going to go through the whole story, but I did see the video, which was quite remarkable. What they had was individual little pieces of plastic with hinges. Kind of microscopic hinges.
Wow.
In this fabric. And what they did is they printed the entire dress as a small block. You couldn't tell it's a dress. It just looked like a small block of plastic. And then it just expanded, and they put it on a woman. She wore it, and it looked like a regular dress. But it's interesting, when they printed it, it was just a very small block of plastic, and then they sort of unraveled it. And that's the clever part of this 3D printing story. We love our 3D printing story.
That's right.
All right, let's do just a real quick Media Matters Minute, and then we're going to get to our Florida vets and talk about some issues having to do with the environment.
We're quick to attack Jeb Bush in response to his decision to actively explore a 2016 presidential bid. Here's how Fox News' outnumbered co-host Kennedy responded to Bush's potential bid.
I think what he has to do, honestly, is he has to rebrand himself because people are over the political dynasties.
Rush Limbaugh speculated on his radio show.
You want to know why Jeb Bush is thinking of running? They're going to pull out all the stops to make sure that a Tea Party type conservative doesn't get the nomination. And if that means somebody like Jeb, it could be a sacrificial run just to make sure that a conservative doesn't get the nomination in 2016.
And on Fox's Your World, frequent Fox guest Donald Trump argued.
I think the last thing we need is another Bush. I've had it with the Bushes.
Jeb Bush's announcement was also lambasted by many other right-wing media outlets, including the American Conservative, Town Hall, and Breitbart. For more on this and other stories, please visit MediaMatters.org.
Media Matters is a nonprofit organization. They're in Washington, D.C. They listen to the conservative misinformation and report it. You're listening to WSLR 96.5 LPFM in Sarasota, Florida. Your true community radio station, Surreal News, your weapon of mass instruction. Lou Larini is going to introduce our next guests.
We are very happy to welcome back Gene Jones, president of Florida Veterans for Common Sense, and his colleague John Darvek, a biologist and Air Force veteran, who co-authored a report for these guys on carbon emissions and why it is so urgent that we reduce them. I can't talk and look at the same time. Welcome, Gene and John, and thanks for coming on.
Thank you very much,
thanks
Lou.
Thanks for having us, Lou.
Yeah, beautiful. Okay, you know, we've all heard an awful lot about how the planet is warming, and, you know, most people, I say, fear the consequences, while some prefer to ignore the overwhelming and compelling evidence of its occurrence and our contribution to it. What does your report reveal about the urgency of this problem?
Well, Lou, first I'd like to say some people may ask why a veterans group is taking a position on climate change. And the goal of our group is really to continue our service. And we do that by trying to educate ourselves on national security issues and the public on those types of issues. And several years ago, it came to our attention that climate change was a possible national security threat, and we started to look into that. And then, not to our surprise, the Department of Defense came out with a report that said that climate change is a threat to our national security. And so we thought that we should look into that with more detail and see what we could do to help our communities work on ways to possibly reverse change this climate change situation, because it's clear from the consensus of the scientific community that man's activities, our energy production, our burning of fossil fuels is contributing to the carbon dioxide and methane in the air, which is causing global warming. And although that science, we might say, is not perfect, from the veterans' perspective and from the Department of Defense perspective, even if there's some chance that that's wrong, it's a very small chance. And the way we look at it, even if we're wrong about that and we're not influencing climate change, if we were absolutely wrong about that, still the suggestions that we have can improve our economy, make our environment much cleaner and safer. And so that's why we did the report as veterans.
Okay. You know, fill me in with just like a little bit of a detail about how this does affect our national security. I know that you're referring to a Defense Department report. How would totally ignore the warming of the planet and the seas rise and all this other stuff happens. How does that affect our national security, just for our listeners' gratification?
Well, that's been put in. You can put that into different categories,
of course,
depending on your point of view. One list I came up with, you got a problem with food supply. As temperatures rise, the food supply can go down. You can have all these droughts. You can have flooding. All of it can take away food. So there's some risk of the food supply. And of course, in a situation like that, the powerful will grab the food, and the less powerful will grab their guns and try to get it back. So you're looking at some security problems there. Fresh water, even worse, even more important to life, and so even more ferocious conflict there. Migrations and refugee problems at all sorts of borders, because countries can't perhaps take care of their people, and you can have conflicts at borders from that. Sea level rise, something dear to our hearts in Florida. There was just an article in the newspaper this morning about what's going on up in Norfolk, where it's becoming a real problem. And that, of course, is a huge naval base, and the people in the surrounding area having to elevate their houses, and it's costing more than the house is worth, so. All these problems are not out in Kiribati and Tuvalu and places like that. Disruption of trade routes is another one they talk about. You've opened up the whole North Atlantic now, and who's going to own it? And are there going to be pirates there? Sure. Are there going to be rogue military vessels getting into trouble up there with each other? And just military operations, like Norfolk is our largest naval base, and it's going underwater.
We have so much climate variability. As the climate changes, it's causing unanticipated consequences. Good arguments can be made that the conflicts in Syria and Iraq are exacerbated by climate change over there. In Syria, they had one of the worst droughts in history back in 2006-2007. Well, if you look back, you can see that from that drought, farmers at first, they adapted to the drought by pumping water from the ground level. But they pumped down the underground water levels, it got lower and lower and worse. The water that they were starting to get up was filled with salts and nitrates, so they could no longer irrigate their fields. What happened to those farmers? They migrated, as John said, into the cities. And how do they support themselves when they get into the city? So there's not enough food. There's social turmoil. Migration. Isn't that a ripe area for terrorists and groups like ISIS?
Well, it causes instability. I mean, that's actually
clearly true. Yeah. Clearly instability.
Yeah.
And we see the rise of groups like ISIS, et cetera. Now, that's not to say, don't misunderstand me, that that's a direct cause. But as the Defense Department says, it's certainly a factor. I mean, that's recognized to be a factor.
Threat multiplier is the term.
That's a fancy term that they use, multiplier. And you're seeing this in a lot of places around the world. You're seeing that, obviously, in Iraq and Syria. You're seeing the water resources that John's talking about. The water coming out of the mountains that feeds the Tigris-Euphrates River is down by 45% at times.
Wow.
Well, if that's not managed properly, people are dependent on those rivers and lakes and that system for their food supply, not only to irrigate their crops, but for fishing, et cetera. A lot of those lakes have dried up. Well, you can't make a living as a fisherman if your lake has dried up.
Mm-hmm. Can I just mention one other thing you're talking about? Diseases as well, and that also destabilizes populations as well.
That's a very, very correct, Steve. I mean, and we see that in places, anywhere there's vast riverine systems, they're being affected by climate change and the variability. Look at a place like Nigeria, where there's turmoil. We're sending troops over to Nigeria now. And we have this group, an Al-Qaeda affiliate, Noko Bakam or something
Boko,
like that.
Boko Haram.
Some group in Nigeria. And Nigeria, it's unbelievable how poor it is and getting poorer because of the effect on the riverine system there.
Sure.
The variability. The rainfall is either too much or too little for the farmers to be able to maintain their crops. Their food production is down like 45%. And as Steve mentioned, migrations into the city, they don't have sanitation.
Yeah.
30-40% of them maybe have sanitation. The rest of them have no sanitation. So diseases become rampant.
Okay, all right. That's a great job detailing what the problem actually is, and I just want to let our listeners know we're speaking to Gene Jones and John Darovic from Florida Veterans for Common Sense. This is WSLR 96.5 FM. Now, as always, I know you guys are solution-oriented folks. First of all, how much time do we reasonably have to, you know, try to affect this problem, and what can people do?
Well, I think we're about 25 years past where we should be.
Okay.
There's one way of looking at that.
All right.
If that's for time, and what do we do? In our paper, we tried to address that at a couple different levels. What's the individual to do? And I think a lot of folks know what that is. They want to, change their light bulbs, caulk their windows, upgrade their insulation, and all that sort of stuff helps. And then you go to whatever group you might belong to and say, look how much money I was able to save by doing this. And so then your group gets involved. And ultimately, at the third level would be to convince your government, your policymakers to do something to incentivize all this. And that's the part of all this that's near and dear to my heart as a member of Citizens Climate Lobby. Our idea is to get our Congress folks to pass a bill that is, we've described it different ways. Currently, we're calling it a carbon fee and dividend. That is, you tax the producers of coal, oil, and gas, and don't let the money stay with the government, though. You take that money and have it go back to consumers. Why? Because, well, the coal, oil, and gas people are going to raise their prices, and that raises the cost of the entire economy. So by giving the money back to the consumers, you offset that, and you actually, as it turns out, stimulate the economy. We had a group called Regional Economic Models Incorporated check on this kind of a program. And what they found is that it's good for the economy. You know, you've heard all, we won't mention names, but politicians saying, you do anything about the
coal and the gas industry?
Yeah, you're gonna bring the economy to its knees, you know. Well, it turns out that's not the case.
Sorry, Mitch.
It turns out that is not the case.
Yeah.
The economy is stimulated because you're returning that money to the consumers.
It sounds like a real common sense solution, you know, which really plays into you guys, because we are in a quote unquote, there is such a thing as the free market, you know, so if you tax the producers of carbon, the big producers of carbon, be it coal and oil, say, then they're going to have to offset that. They in the free market, to stay in business, they're going to offset that by raising their prices. Now, if that money, that tax money, goes back to consumers then are going to have a choice, right?
Exactly. This is what levels the playing field for the whole situation and facilitates the transition from coal, oil, and gas to non-combustion forms of energy,
sure,
is the way I tend to phrase that.
Yeah.
Can I put my two cents in? Because we had guests on recently.
That's right.
There is currently laws that penalize you if you put up solar panels. It's not just an even...
here in Florida.
That's a real problem in Florida.
You're
penalized. Yes. Yeah, that's a problem in Florida.
And of course, the oil industry is subsidized, so it's not even nearly a level playing field here.
And Florida, Steve, that's a... Excuse me.
Go ahead.
In Florida, that's a problem that we have because we're the Sunshine State, and we could more easily... We have the third highest solar resources of all the states, but we're way down the list on taking advantage of that solar resource. Georgia, the governor in Georgia, said we're going to jump over Florida and we're going to become the Sunshine State because they have massively invested in solar power in Georgia, and they're way ahead of Florida, which is, in our opinion, just absolutely ridiculous. One of the differences, they have an elected public service commission. We have a public service commission that's appointed by the governor, and their interest is not in advancing the needs of consumers and generating alternative sources of power. Their interest is maintaining the profit levels of these large corporations. So it's something we have to address in Florida. We could have solar thermal plants here in the Sarasota-Manatee area, which would generate a good portion of our power. We could generate that power from the free sunshine that we have most every day, but we can't do it.
Well, people have to realize why outfits like Duke Energy and TECO spend so much money to get certain politicians elected and not change these laws, because they apparently earn their money from proposing and building new power plants. They can't propose and build new power plants because these are like seriously subsidized by taxpayers, whether they build them or not, and they can add rate hikes and they make tons of money off that. But they can't justify it unless there is a growing need for power. Now, if we're getting our power from the sun, then it makes it harder for them to justify that, so that's competition for them. And it is a broken system. It's yet another. I mean, it's become a cliche right now, but it is yet another broken system in our wonderful world.
Well, with these alternatives that we have, we're suggesting that we need to start looking at these alternatives, and one of the good ways to do it, we concluded, and consistent with this REMI study, I mean, that's very exciting, that actually the economy can be stimulated and employment increased by having a rational environmental policy and a rational policy on carbon emissions. Okay, by reducing those carbon emissions,
absolutely,
we increase the viability and diversity of the economy. It's a win-win situation, and we should be doing that.
And also, it's a federal-level thing, so you kind of bypass this problem of Florida not being as legislative or legally friendly for solar as Georgia is, in fact. And New Jersey may even be more of a sunshine state than Georgia, if you look into it, I think. But it will level the playing field at kind of a higher level in our government, and we can perhaps bypass some of these difficulties at state level and that sort of thing.
Well, if we all don't want to end up underwater, I guess we're going to need to do something and do something soon, even though I agree with you. We are about 25 years too late, but there are things that can be done.
And we have to do them soon. I mean, when we talk about these problems in Syria and Nigeria and these other places around the world, it's home.
Yeah.
And we can see it with the sea level rise in Norfolk. We can see it in Miami. You know, when they're pumping out the streets in Miami, it's not a high tide.
Yeah,
it's
right.
a rising sea level.
Right.
And you have the situation, the drought in California, which... most of us don't realize this, but the Central Valley in California produces something like half of our vegetable crops.
Yeah.
It's very important to our food supply. Now, they're in the same situation with that drought in California that Syria and Iraq were in, a very similar system because they irrigate the crops there from a riverine system,
right,
from the water that flows down from the mountains. When they're in this drought, a prolonged drought for a long period of time, the production of the agricultural resource in that area goes down. What is that going to do to us as that agricultural resource changes? Our food prices are going to go up. Food's going to become more scarce. Well, already we know in Sarasota there's people that can't afford to buy food now.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you what. Another thing that they can't afford to buy is good medical attention, and I think our second guests can address that today because we are getting into that. Gene, thank you very much. That was very informative. Hope you stick around, and maybe we can talk about it a little more.
All right. Do we have time for a quick Media Matters minute, and then we'll move on?
I think that would be good, and then we can talk to Dr. Richard Conrad and Glenn Gibellina.
All right. Let's go ahead and do that.
This is the Media Matters Minute. I'm Coleman Lowndes. Fox News figures are using a fatal hostage situation in Sydney, Australia, to justify CIA torture. On Fox & Friends, co-host Elizabeth Hasselbeck cited the hostage situation in Sydney to lament the criticism that the CIA is facing in the wake of the Senate Intelligence Committee's report on the CIA's torture program.
When you see what's happening in Australia today, right now, in a chocolate shop, and you understand the real war with ISIS that we're in, it's the sharp contrast with the accusations of the CIA really just trying to do their job and keep America safe for the past 13 years startles you.
Fox News foreign correspondent Leland Vittert also invokes the CIA report while discussing the Australian hostage situation.
Just recently, over the past week, we've seen this fallout play out over the Senate intelligence report as it related to enhanced interrogation techniques by the CIA. Does something like this justify, once again, the need for sometimes bending the law, perhaps some people would even say breaking the law, in the interest of public safety?
For more on this and other stories, please visit Media Matters.
All right, once again, that's Media Matters, a nonprofit out of Washington, D.C., and they listen to all that media misinformation and report it on this show. And once again, you're listening to WSLR 96.5 LPFM in Sarasota, Florida, your true community radio station. We're it. And your weapon of mass instruction, the Surreal News, right here in Sarasota, Florida. We're delighted to be here. And my co-host, Lou Larini, he's going to introduce our next guest about remote area medical.
We are fortunate to have today with us local activist, I believe both you guys are from Manatee County, Glenn Gibellina and Dr. Richard Conrad, who I erroneously introduced as a retired physician. He is actually practicing, but they are both related to remote area medical, which is also known as RAM. It is a nonprofit organization that provides free health care to folks in remote areas in right now several states in the United States and other countries. And they would like to come to Florida, but state law here in Florida prohibits doctors from other states from practicing here for free. Welcome, guys. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you, sir. Nice to be here.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
First off, why don't you tell us a little bit more about RAM, where it came from, how long it's been around, a little bit of the history here.
Yes, this is a volunteer, non-for-profit organization started by a Mr. Stan Brock out of Tennessee, and is really the result of having a personal need when he was working in the Amazon in South America and became injured and recognized that medical help was 26 days away.
A 26-day walk, I believe.
That's correct. 26-day walk. And as this became sort of a vision for him, he realized that the need in America itself is just tremendous, especially among the most needy, who many times are not getting medical, dental, optical type of care. So he has taken this as a life's work and created RAM, and by invitation goes into communities and has attracted volunteer professionals to give of their time to help meet that need.
Didn't he first form this organization, I guess, I guess it was around 1985?
That's correct, yeah.
So it's been around for some time, and I think it started...
30-plus years.
Yeah, it started in Guyana, but then he came to the United States, and tell us now, I mean, even though, you know, I know Mr. Brock is in, you know, Tennessee, and I guess, you know, Ram is pretty active in Tennessee. How did you guys get involved? How did you get involved?
Well, Mr. Gibellina brought it to my attention after he had gone to one of their events up in Tennessee.
Okay.
And as I studied, I was a little bit of a skeptic initially, so I went up to one of these events only to be deeply touched by the effect of kind of man's humanity of man, as these professionals at their own expense came into a community and within about a day and a half had provided upwards to $500,000 worth of free dental, medical, and optical care to just very, very needy people who came from very remote areas around there to try to receive this care.
Tell me a little bit about what these events actually were, that they were, you know, sort of like a bunch of tents or something with a, you know.
No, actually, they will go into an area that will accommodate it, a large arena or a large ball game park inside. And such. And they will set up actual dental chairs. I think the one that we were at had 26 or 28. They can set up as many as 100 of these. And then professional volunteers who have become aware of this, and over a period of the last 30 years, he's attracted about 80,000 professionals.
Wow.
When he announces an event, they make it a priority to come, give of their services free. And interestingly enough, with the Affordable Care Act, dental and optical are really not a part of that care, so that seems to be the most wanted and desired, and you'd see people coming in just in serious pain from years and years of bad dental hygiene and
sure.
such as that, and people who haven't really been able to read a newspaper for years. They for example, pull a van in that can make 500 pairs of glasses a day under special prescription to give out to the people.
That's amazing. You know, also too, you know, like the whole business about dental. Even folks who can afford dental insurance realize that you know, it falls kind of short. You know, I mean, aside from giving you a few free cleanings, most dental insurance doesn't even pay for a single crown. So, you know, it's almost all out of pocket. And if you are a person of limited means, you know, I can see where that would go on the back burner. But also, too, as human beings, we all know if you can't see and you can't chew, your life is pretty miserable.
That's correct. And the nutrition is not only the part of that, because if you have seriously diseased dental problems, that affects
absolutely
many parts of the body.
Oh, with absolutely.
That infectious process.
Yeah.
Correct. Yeah.
And, you know, so this all sounds great. And you get involved. I'm assuming you must be one of the doctors that volunteers at some of these events.
Actually, I've only gone to one event, and I went mainly for the purposes of meeting Mr. Brock and his senior administrative people, and to speak at length to many of these volunteers that come as far away. For that one came from New Jersey, New York, Ohio, from many, many remote areas. I wanted to get a feel for what they as professionals were experiencing in their volunteerism for this.
Yeah, okay. What states is this available in now?
It's presently available in 10 different states.
Okay.
And what it really requires to accomplish this is enabling legislation that will allow a professional who's licensed in one state for a very limited period of time, which is the event, which is usually a weekend, to provide his services or her services at no expense. They don't get paid for this.
Right.
But to do that in a state where they are not licensed.
And this is sort of the problem here in Florida, why you guys can't set these things up here in Florida, because the legislature is reluctant to...
Well, I think I don't know if I'd use the word reluctant, because we've met with the representatives, state representatives in our area, and they're very receptive to putting in this legislation. I think it's a matter of clarity and of educating the licensure people as well as the legislators of the vast opportunity to meet this very, very needy program, and then they will get this this legislation handle. I'm very confident.
Sure. My co-host, Steve, has a question.
Hi there. I'm also a medical professional. I'm a physician as well. And I know that there is good Samaritan laws if somebody's by the side of the road and they're, and I need to give them emergency care. There is some protection for me to do that. I'm not. I don't know what the laws are, for example, in other states, and what those restrictions. Do you know?
Well, I only know that you have to be able to pass this enabling legislation to legally bring non-licensed professionals into the state to practice their profession.
Gotcha.
And in this particular case, there is no liability because they are immune by the patients aren't holding them liable, and they're immune by the RAM program as well as the venue that they're in. So unless there's something I'm overlooking, there is just no downside to this. This is just a great, great humanitarian effort.
I'll just comment because I was visiting in Canada, for example, and they don't have the Good Samaritan laws that we have here in the United States. It's different for different countries. I did not know that.
Yeah, that's interesting. And, you know, I guess, you know, we do have a need here in Florida, you know, especially since, you know, the state legislators and I guess, well, the governor can change his mind, but I mean, it's the legislators, you know, decided not to accept, you know, the federal money to expand Medicaid in this state. So, you know, I mean, from what I understand, I mean, that left, you know, several million people, you know, sort of, you know, sort of in between, you know, weren't poor enough to get Medicaid, but didn't make enough to qualify for the premiums for the Affordable Care Act. So they're still kind of, you know, out without, I believe it's like a million, I guess, without any medical help at all and or health care at all. And this program like this would be able to help them, right?
Oh, this program absolutely addresses the need that's unmet at the present time. And you brought up, I think, a very important point, and that is this Affordable Care Act. The discussion has really just begun on that because the further we go and the closer on implementation of aspects of it, we realize that this legislation is very flawed legislation, and it's having a very widespread effect. Even it's projected that as many as 40 million people who are presently having insurance won't have it in the next 10 years. So the discussion is just starting, but the fact that we did not set up our own insurance exchange in Florida could have as much as a $54 billion impact, which is going to affect everything from individuals all the way up through hospitals and all professionals.
Okay. Are you referring to that upcoming Supreme Court decision about the language in the Affordable Care Act that says you can only provide premiums for, you know, through state-run?
That's going to be an exceedingly interesting decision on the Supreme Court, because depending on how they deal with that, that could almost invalidate the legislation.
That's a game changer
itself.
Right there,
a tremendous game changer, truly is. Yeah, yeah.
You know, when though, in fact, though, you know, you read the entire thing, and you know, it's pretty clear that you know, when they refer to changes, they mean exchanges, whether the federal government set them up or the state did. But you know, if somebody, I guess, really wants to be sort of, I can't say the right word because it's I can't say it on family radio. You know, they could you know, nullify the whole thing. But I mean, is this what you're talking about? I mean, I do understand that the Affordable Care Act and you know, just you know in the you know, interest of full disclosure, you know I supported it. I mean I think universal health care is a great idea, but to be honest with you, you know I really think the solution to the problem myself, it's my own personal opinion, is a single payer and that they had a tap dance around that.
Yes, and I think you're hitting right on the essence of it, and that is the motivation of the government for this legislation is to have single-payer health care, and that it will be then under the control of the government. And what I think we have to really recognize is there's a difference between state-provided health care and universal health care and socialized medicine, and I think that's part of the discussion that's going to get clarified.
I think you're right. Absolutely. Let's get back to RAM, though. Remote access medical. When people come to one of these events, is there any income test? Is there anything? Just show up and.
This is
Glenn Gibellini.
Yes, I've worked a few events and. We have a policy that we don't ask for a driver's license, a medical card. We don't care if you have insurance or not. Often these folks wait days out in the parking lot just to get a number, just to get a number to come in there. And when RAM rolls up, they're pretty self-sufficient. I worked one in Tennessee that was done at a high school. And in that high school was a gun range, and we turned the ROTC gun range into an eye clinic. That worked out very well because of the lighting. And then we took the basketball court, and we set up 80 chairs. And they bring in their own generators, and they provide all their own power. And the collaboration of the community and the schools themselves, we had the football team unloading these huge dental chairs, and we were set up and ready to roll in less than 4 hours.
Wow.
We had the cheerleaders and some of the other organizations within the high school running the laptop computers, 30 of them, to process all of these people, these people that desperately needed the health care, and they got it done. And while they're doing that, we had a bus out there that gave mammograms. We took their blood pressure. We had a physician on board. But like Dr. Conard said, that most of these people are hurting from toothaches. They can't see, and that affects the rest of the organs. But when they come in, they're pretty self-sufficient, and it's a great thing to watch.
It is interesting to watch because this whole thing is a volunteer effort. They will have students that they teach to process these clients, and they're processing 150 people an hour through this situation. The entire thing is volunteer.
How many of these events a year does RAM put on?
I think it's about 32 or 33. They've done 747 of them over this 30-year period and never had a bad result or a bad incident.
So they're doing almost one every 1.5 weeks, basically.
Correct. Yeah,
yeah.
That's
yeah,
correct.
Somewhere.
Yeah. And they're doing anywhere from $500,000 to $1.5 million worth of care to the community each time they do that. And what I think we have an interesting challenge of here is if you look at our senior population, what we want them to do is to come in a day early and dedicate that first day by having the churches who have buses and this sort of thing bring some of these elderly people to the clinic. And then I was talking also with the Goodwill people. They've got a tremendous volunteer work staff and lower socioeconomic work staff that we should dedicate time to see that their needs are met also.
Yeah. Actually, you can step outside of this studio, and look a little bit to the right, and you see there is a need for this, kind of service here in Florida. There are an awful lot of people who probably have not seen a doctor in
maybe forever.
Decades.
Yeah, and when you look at our two communities, in Sarasota alone, there's something like 1,200 children who are homeless. And in Manatee County, depending on who you listen to, as much as 1,500 to 1,800. And with that, just the challenge of feeding over the weekend, there's all sorts of community programs that step forward with this, but that's just the tip of the iceberg. And I just think it's it's exemplary to realize that professionals around the country, when mobilized properly, when invited into a community, can have a tremendous impact on the needs of the neediest, literally.
Yeah. You know, you had mentioned earlier that, you know, you'd spoken to some of the local legislators. You know, can you name any names? Is anybody, like, going to step up and be a champion?
You bet. We've spoken with Representative Stubbe, Representative Boyd, and Representative Gonzalez from down in the Venice area. It's pretty well set up right now that in the House, Representative Gonzalez will be putting legislation in that then will be co-sponsored by Representative Boyd and Stubbe. We are getting ready to meet within the next 30 days with Senator Galvano. So I think we're going to have a tremendous effort coming locally that'll help get this enabling legislation put in place.
You know, it does sound like, you know, something that, you know, they may be in support of. You know, I know Bill Galvano does have his one-stop center up there in Manatee County, you know, and has shown some, you know, empathy for, you know, our less fortunate residents.
They do a marvelous job over there. They call that turning points in the clinic now. And Bill has been very instrumental, as was Senator John McKay when he was in the legislature.
Yeah.
And we've got a wonderful program going on there.
Great. You know, I'm not exactly sure. When does the legislature come back in a session?
They start their committee work literally next month. I think they go into session in March. We have every anticipation to be ready to try to move forward this effort.
Yeah, you expect to be on the docket or going into committee like right away? Are you going to be in that first group of bills?
I'd like to say yes. I don't control that, but
right.
We certainly have received tremendous reception by the legislators, and this is a program that Mr. Brock is very interested in doing in Florida, and I think you're going to find, at least from what I saw in Tennessee, we will have huge national recognition in these two communities with this event that's getting ready to happen late next year.
Well, yeah, Florida certainly fits the bill.
I mean,
you know, we do have some remote areas, and they do need medical help. Yes, Steve.
I have a question for you because there are some physicians here in Florida that are willing also to volunteer. How about a clinic here just with Florida physicians, so you don't have to violate that rule?
Yes, what we will be doing is we, through the medical, dental, and optical organizations, we will be announcing this and really requesting that our physicians within the state be our volunteers. This doesn't have to include tremendous numbers of out-of-state volunteers, but from the research that I have done historically, if we start to approximate meeting the need, we need more help than we just have locally, and yet, as I say, they will have first option to be the volunteers, and we applaud that, and we'll solicit that.
Okay, that sounds great, you know, and obviously we will support you as much as we can here at WSLR because I think it's a worthy cause, or at least I will, And I want to thank you guys for coming on. If somebody wants to learn more about this or find some way that they can help with the effort, how would they do that?
You can go up online to www.usaram.org, and there's a great deal of information on that. And Glenn, do you have further thought on that also?
Yes, you know, Ram's organization does not have any large contributors. He is basically run by $5 and $10 contributions from the community. So I would encourage you, it's going to come back tenfold. So if you want to contribute to this great organization, it's www.usaram.org.
And it is money that goes directly into the effort, and there isn't, especially if you click that button on your website, you don't have to worry about some telemarketer getting 95 cents of your dollar.
That's absolutely correct, and to give you the feeling for the sort of dedication, Mr. Brock does not receive any salary and has never had it through the 30-plus years that he's taken and gone forward with this effort.
He's a pretty interesting guy himself, too, though.
And I
would encourage people to go on the website just to read Stan Brock's story, who used to be on Mutual of Omaha's Wild Kingdom.
He's really a great patriot.
Okay?
All right, Steve. Well, thank you very much to all our guests in the studio, and you've been listening to The Surreal News, and thank everybody for joining us. Let me just remind everybody the news and views you heard here are not those of WSLR. It's board members. It's employees. It's just the people that gave them, the co-hosts and our guests. Take what you like and leave the rest. Tonight we have a very special program going on tonight at the Fogartyville Center here, and that's our tribute to Phil Oakes. And we're going to have Jim Glover and C.C. Carter, John Howard, Mindy Simmons, James Hawkins, Robert Killen, Steve McAllister, and Carrie Chaney all giving a tribute to Phil Oakes. That's tonight at 8. Doors open at 7. I'm not sure if there's tickets still available, but you can call 894-6469 and get more information. That's 894-6469. And again, if you missed any part of the show, go to thesurrealnews.com. We're also live streaming at WSLR.org and at WSLR 96.5 LPFM in Sarasota, Florida, your true community's radio station. And this has been your weapon of mass instruction, The Surreal News. Right after this show, we have Complex Waveforms with Mark Zimpella. And that's coming right up. All right, so I want to thank everybody again for participating. And you too, any words, wisdom, Lou, on the way out?
No, I think it was a great show. You know, and I'm happy everybody could make it. And it's nice having a lot of people in the studio.
Thank you, Lou.
Nice
thank
having you so much, Lou,
and Steve.
In the studio here. All right, here's some great music with Mark Zimpella. Don't touch that dial.